For those listening to KSPN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with Reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program designed to restore the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. The number to call in is 844-320-4299. That is a toll-free number. As I always say, for those who are just listening or hearing this for the first time, many parts of these shows will refer to previous shows, and these shows build off of each other. Consequently, to stay abreast with our content and the information that we promulgate, you will need to listen to all of these shows to garner what Republic Review is and how we can reclaim the Republic. Don't forget, you can download the podcasts and stay abreast that way by downloading them from ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. Local announcements. Stevens County is going to be doing a Lincoln Day dinner on the 6th of May. And if you've never been to one, it's a fundraiser that the GOP has, and each of the counties have their own Lincoln Day dinners, and it's that season to do that. If you've never been to one, and especially the Stevens County one, having gone last year, it was a lot of fun. They auction off desserts and so forth, and it is a good, fun evening. You will enjoy every minute of it. There are speakers and so forth. Spokane County's hosting of the GOP, or I should say the hosting of their Lincoln Day dinner by the Spokane County GOP will be June 3rd, so you can get your tickets before they're gone. Let's take a quick constitutional look at the recent events this week. And as a matter of fact, just one particular one I want to focus on, and that is what the Senate is doing by getting rid of the Republican form of governance. And that Republican form of governance has always been a form of allowing the minority to keep the majority from oppressing it and being able to use forms of democracy or mob rule, 50 plus one, so forth. The Senate is supposed to represent the states and the Republic and not the people. The people's representatives are in the House of Representatives. This is how the 17th Amendment has perverted our Republic, and we need to repeal that. But until then, what is happening today is we see the Republic, or we, the Republic, can see what is being done by converting these rules of engagement in the Senate from going to a constitutional or Republican form where they require 60 votes or 67 votes for a consensus or for an approval of a Supreme Court justice or a constitutional amendment and so forth, and they're literally watering it down to a 50 plus one. The Democrats have been doing this, and the progressives have been doing this for years. And if we get into that boat, what we need to do is undo all of this. But in context of what the framers had done, the framers knew that the importance of not allowing a simple majority to rule and oppress the minority. And this is the very dangerous, or these are very dangerous times. And at this time, allowing the Senate to change its form of governance, as it's done historically through the past century, is just, it's a dangerous move. It may be good for one side right now. In other words, the Republicans or what people perceive as the conservatives are going to win something, but the Constitution and our Republic is at stake here. No one side ever possesses a monopoly. In other words, the Democrats or the Republicans never possess a monopoly in representation. Unless we abolish the 17th Amendment, then one side can actually possess a monopoly, and that would be the states. if the states took over and appointed the Senate members to go and represent them in the Senate instead of the election process that the 17th Amendment introduced, then the states would always possess the majority of being able to protect what's their best interest and the best interest of their citizens. It was one of the greatest steps towards democracy and a destruction or putting a huge chink in our constitutional republic when Wilson in 1917 passed the 17th Amendment. This means that when the other side has the majority, when the Republicans are no longer the majority in the Senate, they will be able to ram down our throats despotism that will further destroy our republic. In 1917, a threat to use what is now known as the nuclear option resulted in a reform of the Senate's filibuster rules. This was a progressive reform of what was installed as a Republican form of governance. An opinion written by Vice President Richard Nixon in 1957 concluded that the U.S. Constitution grants the presiding officer the authority to override the Senate rules. Nixon was wrong, and he was a progressive Republican. The nuclear option was used to make further rule changes in 1975. As I have said before, this ratcheting effect is how they boil the frog. So they've been gradually sliding the rules a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. Anyway, in November 2013, Harry Reid and the Senate Democrats used the nuclear option to eliminate filibusters on executive branch nominations and federal judicial appointments other than those to the Supreme Court so that they could ram down our throats progressive appointments. This was the beginning of the end, and those who think that this is good when the Republicans use this, they're forgetting that the Democrats will use this too for their advantage. The minority has been protecting us for centuries, and we need to get back to Republican form of government so the minority can continue to protect us. Before November 2013, Senate rules required 3/5 vote of the duly sworn senators, basically required 60 votes, to end debate on a bill for a nomination or another proposal to move forward. They also require a 2/3 vote for voting on things of changing their rules or making a constitutional amendment. Those rules effectively allowed a minority of the Senate to block a bill, as I've been saying, or a nomination through the technique of the filibuster. This had resulted in de facto requirements that a nomination has the support of 60 senators to pass rather than the majority of 51. We're better off waiting 2 more years and doing other things, like I said, fixing the judiciary, reeling it in so they can't do anything anymore, so they can't legislate from the bench and do their constitutional encroachments. A 3/5 vote is still required to end debates on legislation, the Supreme Court nominations, unless they use this nuclear option. And then the only thing left is, again, the legislation, and if they use the nuclear option on that as well to ram forward these agendas, just remember that the throat is going to be open when the tide shifts and progressives hold the Senate. We have to get back to republicanism and how the framers implemented it. If not, our republic will be destroyed by the tyranny of democracy or mob rule because of the Senate. I'm not going to talk about this more right now, but I am going to talk more about this in 2 weeks as we go down this path, because the Constitution guarantees in Article 4, Section 4, every state be guaranteed a Republican form of government. And every state in the union is violating that. And we're going to get into how we can really fix this, and we could do it very easily within the next 2 years. All we need are smart people to kind of put aside their self-interest and their differences and work together in moving the states back to a Republican form government, as well as moving our nation back towards a Republican form government as well, and getting the 17th Amendment repealed. There's easy ways of doing this. So I'm not going to focus on that now. For this show, I want to get back to the matter of the federal government and how it's violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause by creating a national secular church. And we'll be back right after this quick break, since I hear the music in my ear. So please stay tuned, and we'll get into the First Amendment's violation of the Establishment Clause, or the federal government's violation. Thank you. You will find consistent advice among financial advisors, conservative entertainers, preppers, and those who have legitimate concern about our currency and our government. They all recommend holding precious metals in some way and degree for varying reasons. I, too, recommend precious metals, especially holding it in your possession in a secure storage system for several reasons. One, it can protect you from the inflation of a fiat currency. Two, some coins can be used in bartering in an absolute emergency. And three, this is a good way to pass wealth down to your posterity. If you're looking to add precious metals to your portfolio or to your holdings, I would like to show you how you can get these metals for less than how I can get them. You heard that correct, for less than how I can get them. And I believe you cannot beat this price. Let me explain. My broker's company has, I believe, the lowest set price for all metals on the market. And just like all other precious metal companies, they offer commission to those who refer others, which most times this affects the bottom line price. Well, my broker's company does not adjust the price. They have a flat buy and selling price. And I have worked it out with my broker to take a portion of my commission to offer you a discount to let you save money on your purchases for slightly lower than the price, than the selling price that I get them for. It may be a slight discount, but a discount nonetheless. If you're interested in buying physical metals at the lowest price and learning more about this deal, contact me via email at metals, with an S at the end, at reclaimingtherepublic.org. And I will introduce you to my broker, and he can give you the pricing and how you will actually pay less than me. Again, that's metals, M-E-T-A-L-S, at reclaimingtherepublic.org. All right. Well, thank you for staying tuned. We are back. And as I was going into the break, I was clearly stating a very bold assertion. But in all honesty, I wasn't the first one to ever assert this. Neil Maxwell, as a matter of fact, the one person you may have heard of is Milton Friedman. In Milton Friedman's book, Free to Choose, he basically made the assertion that the federal government has been violating the First Amendment Establishment Clause for quite a while. And so we've talked about this 2 weeks ago when we talked to Mark, and we've got Mark on. We're going to bring him back. I want to set the stage. The framers really understood the importance of religion, and Mark's book, Believe, is definitely worth getting and getting a better picture of where our framers' paradigms were as far as religion and our involvement in religion as a government. So first, let me prove that this republic was established as a Christian republic and that the federal government was to be a non-denominational, not secular government. So let me first dive into a Federalist paper and a few other citations, and then we'll discuss with Mark, you know, some of the his cases that he's talked about in his book. And this is Federalist paper number 2. This is paragraph 5, and this is John Jay. And he says, with equal pleasure, I have as often taken notice that Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs, and who, by their joint councils, arms, and efforts, fighting side by side, throughout a long and bloody war, have nobly established liberty and independence. So clearly he's identifying that this nation was given to this people by Providence, recognizing the Lord's hand. The next citation is from Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. And this is basically him talking. While I was in America, a witness who happened to be called at the assizes of the county of Chester, state of New York, declared that he did not believe in the existence of God or the immorality of the soul. The judge refused to admit his evidence on the ground that the witness had destroyed beforehand all the confidence of the court in what he was about to say. The newspapers related the fact without any further comment. The New York Spectator of August 23rd, 1831 stated and relates the facts as following. The Court of Common Pleas of Chester County, New York, a few days since, rejected a witness who declared his disbelief in the existence of God. The presiding judge remarked that he had not before been aware that there was a man living who did not believe in the existence of God, that this belief constituted the sanction of all testimony in a court of justice, and that he knew of no case in a Christian country. So they're identifying this as a Christian country where a witness had been permitted to testify without such belief. Moving forward a little bit farther into 1851, Joseph Story, a Supreme Court justice, said this in his biography, the testimony in the court system was based on the individual's sacred worship of God and their ability to affirm their oath to God. In my book, I point out how Supreme Court Chief Justice Joseph Story commented on this issue in his book, Life and Letters of Joseph Story, saying, quote, "Infidels and pagans were banished from the halls of justice as unworthy credit." And that's on page 17 in Joseph Story's book. In Story's perception, infidels were non-Christians similar to heathens, unlike the Islamists' sole usage of this word today. In addition, Story's usage of the word credit, as derived from Latin credo, specifically refers to their ability to trust a heathen. Isn't it ironic that the Islamists follow a Quran doctrine called taqiyya that allows them to outright lie and use deception to further their cause, and they call all, as they call all non-believers, infidels? So I want to bring back Mark Erbach. He was on the show 2 weeks ago. He's a former public school teacher and an author of two books, Heal Our Nation, Save Our World in 2010, and Believe, Do We Need a Third Great Awakening in 2015? And the latter book, Believe, is what I just read. I really recommend anybody and all to get a good handle on where we're going and why we've gotten so far down this trench, into this trench by the court system. This book really reveals this. I have read this book, and I would recommend it to anyone who wants to understand what the court has done to force secularism down our throat. Mark's a public speaker on several different topics and a writing candidate for the presidency in 2016. So let me welcome Mark back. Mark, are you there?
Yes, GR. Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be with you.
I greatly appreciate you availing yourself, because this is a very important issue, because the fundamental principles that we have to build on of individual liberty and individual sovereignty are basically founded upon the laws of nature. There we go.
Right.
And the laws of nature were derived as the common accepted laws of Christianity.
True.
And so all of the laws that we inserted and injected and built this nation on were fundamentally founded upon the Christian laws derived from the laws of nature. And so, anyway, when you last came on, we talked a little bit about my thesis, and we talked a bit about the Supreme Court and trying to fix that and so forth. But I want to kind of catch up, and you were talking about the key cases in your book, and I asked you to send that to me, and I did see the email, so thank you.
Okay.
But can you list those cases?
Sure.
Those key cases.
There are six cases, and yes. I started with 1947, Everson versus the Board of Education, whereby Hugo Black completely proved that he didn't have a clue of the true meaning of the First Amendment. And we quoted that. I told you his words last time. Mm-hmm. But this is the paradigm shift that starts in 1947 that starts to remove all the religious freedoms from the schools and thus society. The next case is 1948, McCollum versus Board of Education. And simply, there's a different, a Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish faith formed an association for their children to, attend Bible classes in the public schools. Well, that was decided that's unconstitutional. Next case is 1962, one of the most, vagrant violations of the Constitution. For the first time, made teacher-led prayer unconstitutional in this nation. The first time a court in the history of America said that prayer is illegal, and there was no precedent. It was a 6-1 decision, and the dissent is quite powerful. I want to read the dissent from Potter Stewart, and this proves, though, even though it was a 6-1 decision, the majority won the case. It doesn't mean they were correct. Potter Stewart, the lone dissenter, was correct, and here's his dissent. Again, it was a neutral prayer simply led by the teacher. With all respect, I think the court has misapplied a great constitutional principle. I cannot see how an official religion is established by letting those who want to say a prayer say it. On the contrary, I think that to deny the wish of these schoolchildren to join in reciting this prayer is to deny them the opportunity of sharing in the spiritual heritage of our nation. And he's exactly correct. The next case was 1980, Stone v. Graham, whereby the state of Kentucky passed a ruling, a law saying that the Ten Commandments would be posted in all the classrooms. Goes to the Supreme Court, and you won't believe what the court said. It said, quote, if the posted copies of the Ten Commandments are to have any effect at all, it will be to induce the school children to read, meditate upon, perhaps to venerate and obey the commandments. This is not a permissible state objective under the Seventh Clause. So basically, the Supreme Court of the nation didn't think it was good for the students to read, meditate upon, and perhaps to venerate and obey the commandments.
Oh, next. Hey, Mark, we have a hard break coming up right here. So let's close out the Stone v. Graham,
sure,
and we'll get back to the others as soon as we get back from a break. So please stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back after this. Thank you very much. Okay, so we have Mark on the phone, and he's already gone through a few of the cases that he's cited in his book, Believe. And let me see, I believe you were just wrapping up or kind of summarizing Stone v. Graham,
right,
in 1980.
Yeah, that's 1980, Stone v. Graham. The Supreme Court of the United States said the Ten Commandments cannot be put on a poster on the wall of a classroom. They said the students might read, meditate upon, perhaps to venerate and obey the commandments. And this court said that should not be allowed. A crazy decision, but that's what they decided. The next case is 1992, Lee versus Weissman. Once again, this is dealing with invocations and benedictions. Well, they were legal and constitutionally protected for well over 180 years until 1992. The Supreme Court struck them down. And I put that case in the book, and I actually put the invocation and benediction from Rabbi Lee. It was a very nice prayer, only mentioned God once, and they struck it down. The last case that I have in my book is 1999, Santa Fe Independent School District versus Doe, where, a member of the school, whether it's a principal or a student, saying a prayer at an athletic game, again, was legal for well over 185 years, and then the Supreme Court struck it down. So, all these cases have one thing in common. They were started by Hugo Black with his precedent in 1947, Everson versus Board of Education, where he completely misinterpreted Jefferson's letter containing the phrase, a wall of separation between church and state. And it's in my book, and I put his decision in my book to prove it, that he didn't even understand his own wording, basically.
Well, if I could point out, in any judiciary act, does it allow the Supreme Court to reach into informal communication to use for precedents or to use for rulings in a particular case? Or are they still supposed to be bound by the Constitution and ratified treaties.
The way I understand it is the Founding Fathers, Jefferson, Madison, all those guys, they did not, you know, the court has jurisdiction. It is not to take its hand into the states and intermingle with religious institutions.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. So, yeah, I think we mentioned this before, so I'll reiterate that the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is limited to those enumerated powers within the Constitution.
Right.
And there is no enumerated power for the federal government to regulate religion, prayer, or what have you. So the fact that they're doing this just as, you know, helps us, my assertion that they are practicing or establishing a religious and a religious standard for mm-hmm. public purposes and for the public safety, whatever they want to call it, secularism.
Right.
But what I was lending to is the judiciary acts, the first one and the second one, and all judiciary acts that I know of do not allow the Supreme Court to call upon, even though they have. Sandra Day O'Connor, I think, used some international law rulings to, you know, to swing one way, and other obscure laws that they've injected lately since they've gone into this progressive, you know, downward spiral. But they're supposed to be making their cases based upon the Constitution and ratified treaties. And if it's not, if they can't cite something within the Constitution that to support their argument, then they don't have any support. So when the fact that he has to lead and lend to going to an informal letter that Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists way back in, what, 1803 or 1802?
1802, right.
Yeah, and so that letter itself was an informal letter. Hugo Black pulling that in was well outside the boundaries of what he was supposed to do as a Supreme Court jurist.
Yeah, I always like using examples. Let's talk about Washington served 8 years, two terms. If during those 8 years, or even during John Adams' term, citizens in any of the states, like let's just say Georgia where I live, they wrote a letter to Washington saying, President Washington, we've got a conflict with the official church here in Georgia. We want you to get rid of the official church. Please help us because they're forcing us to pay tax to that church. Washington would take the letter, and he was a genius with the Constitution. He presided over the Constitution and the debates of the Bill of Rights, and he would say, gentlemen, I understand your problem, but I have no power to interfere in a state's religion, you know, a state official church. I can't do that.
Right.
And so that's a perfect example. So for Hugo Black to twist Jefferson's letter is, you know, it's obvious that he knew what he was doing or not, I don't know, but he made the wrong decision.
I think that he knew, and I think that they had already gotten away with enough latitude in previous cases
right.
that they, nobody dare question the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my book, I point out, and it's really more in my second book, I go into the details of seven key landmark cases where John Marshall basically created or allowed in the future generations to inject one case law precedents as well as his rulings created unconstitutional footings in his opinions. The rulings themselves were sound, and Madison didn't find any problems with, okay, yeah, Maryland can't tax the federal government because it has a bank in Maryland.
Right.
So that's a sound ruling, but his babbling in his opinion stated that the federal government was supreme in all things.
Right,
and that
right.
was wrong. But down the road, when they started injecting precedents in case law, they were able to say, hey, well, Marshall said at this point in time that the federal government is supreme in all things. And that's just like in the Torah or in the Bible and the scripture.
Right.
And that's not. The opinions are literally babblings. These men do not have the ability to amend the Constitution. The only sovereign that has the ability to create an amendment to the Constitution are the states.
The people, the states, and the members of Congress that, you know.
Well, I mean, the states are the ones with the
right.
ultimate say because
it
has to be ratified by the state. I mean, it can bubble up from the people via the House of Representatives. It can bubble up in Congress. There's different ways, but the ultimate sovereign in the Constitution and over the Constitution is the states.
Of course, of course.
And so
did you like the quotes in my book? There's one from Joseph Story where he says, thus, the whole power over the subject of religion is left exclusively to the state governments to be acted upon according to their own sense of justice in the state constitution.
Yes.
And then Jefferson saw what was happening with John Marshall. He said, quote, "The Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please," in 1819. And then you go all the way to Chief Justice Charles Evan Hughes, who said, quote, "We are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is." So you have clear, perfect beliefs from Joseph Story.
So hold on. Go back. Who was that last person, and when did they quote that?
Okay. Chief Justice Charles Evan Hughes ruled from 1930 to 1941, and he says, quote, it's in my book, "We are under a constitution, but the Constitution is what the judges say it is."
So that's self-aggrandizing, because bottom line, if he understands the Constitution, in Article 5, it clearly states the parameters of who says what.
Right. Well, he was probably I'm trying to find the page number in my book. I'll find it in a second. But, you know, he said it, and that's –
No. I understand that. But that's – he has completely been ingrained. And that's why when you talk to lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats that are entrenched in what you want to call it constitutional law governance and government and so forth, politicians and lawyers – all come from very similar boys clubs that, you know, only we are trusted with, you know, the mantle of power, when that was never to be vested into them. They're only elected servants to do our will.
Yeah, and it's on page 81 of my book.
Okay.
It was in 1907, his speech at Elmira, May 3rd, 1907.
Okay, there you go. And so it's just common that they self-aggrandize themselves, and it's very common that they try to move themselves into a position of ultimate authority. You know, that's one of the reasons why John Jay refused to go back to the Supreme Court, because he recognized that there was no mantle of power, mm-hmm. that they were basically, yeah, you can do that, or no, you can't do that. You couldn't legislate. You had no executive power or no force, such as the president, like when Hamilton and Washington went and forced the excise tax on whiskey in Kentucky and Tennessee. They got up on the horses and rode out, because they were the executive branch to enforce the laws. And so the Supreme Court was just a know-nothing, you know, body that Jay felt like he was just going to waste himself. He had more ambitions. And so that's why he refused to get reseated back onto the Supreme Court after he came back and failed with the Spanish Treaty or the Treaty of Spain.
Right.
Anywho, I know that we're going to be heading into a break, but when we come back, and I know the music hasn't started yet, but we're about a minute away. What I wanted to do was I wanted to talk about your book, because I think it's just a nuance. I think that it was insightful that you recognized that this Hugo Black and this changing, as you phrased it, was a removal of religion.
Yes.
And to me, I'll give you my sense or my insights on the nuances of that. And I've talked about this before, but we'll be right back. Please stay tuned, folks, and you'll be able to hear the last segment and some profound insights when we come back. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you for staying tuned. We've got Mark on the phone, Mark Urbach, the author of Believe. And Mark, we were just talking about your insights as to how in your book you purport, or you basically assert, that when Hugo Black started this train of events in 1947, that was really the removal of religion, you know, and removing us away from being a Christian nation. And I think that that actually started a long, long time ago. And I believe this is my insight. This is just a nuance, because I think most people would see that, because in the big picture, when people are reading the scriptures and able to say prayer like they used to be able to in school, they still had a moral compass and there was still this moral citizenry that was coming up into the ranks of the electorate. But secularism had advanced so far that we've allowed the Scopes trial, the monkey trial to move forward right. to where we were teaching evolution and other secular progressive dogma in the school systems that, and as a matter of fact, atheists were allowed to start, you know, bearing testimony. Non-believers and non-Christians were be able to take the stand and be able to bear testimony. And so we had watered down, and I think at that point when Hugo Black made this first ruling, and this is my nuance, my difference in how I saw the changing of the guard and the watering down of this Christian republic, that was really the enforcement, the beginning of the enforcement of secularism in this nation, and it started growing on steroids. And if you notice, there were those first two cases in 47 to 48, and then it jumped, you know, there's a long pause until 62.
Right.
And then 80, 92, 99, and now it's just like full bore. States, cities, and everybody, without using the Supreme Court, but kind of knowing that the Supreme Court is looming over them, that they're shutting down Christmas trees and Christmas and other religious holidays, expressions, and so forth, clearly in violation of the First Amendment.
Yeah, you know, Todd Starnes has written two books that I've read, God Less America and The Deplorables Guide to Making America Great Again. Well, there was one, these are all factual events, and a six-year-old girl at an elementary school in Tennessee, her assignment, just like all the other students' assignment, was to write a poem. She dedicated to her grandfathers that fought in Vietnam, and she said, my grandfather prayed to God for his safety, my grandfather prayed to God for his courage, or something like that. Somehow, well, obviously the teacher found out about it, then the principal found out about it, then the superintendent found out about it, and they decided, because of the precedent, you know, the wall of separation, yada, yada, they would not allow her to recite that in front of her classmates. And the craziest thing, I mean, but this is what the whole book is all about, stuff like that.
Oh, sure. And in the school systems, I have a friend that his kid goes to Temecula, one of the Temecula school systems or elementary schools. And they just came down upon him like I can't say a good metaphor that I can say on the air. So anyway, right. They came down upon him really hard and his son, because his son was, you know, referring to Jesus. And yeah. And they've become so militant and in your face. How dare you try to bring that dogma in when they don't even recognize the dogma that they're forcing down our throats. I don't believe there was ever a case in American history that was so dramatic to where Christian churches were, you know, forcing people. Now, maybe in Europe, you know, right, but forcing right. people to believe, forcing people to do their will. It's almost very similar to another faith that we know of that I'll let you speculate.
Right, right.
But there's another faith out there that believes in force.
Of course.
And it's just, it's like I said, there's some real irony and similarities between secularism and this other faith.
Right.
And I'm going, how come people can't see this? How come it's just so blatantly obvious?
They see it. I hear Christians, you know, a lot of my friends are Christians, and I'm a modern Orthodox Jew. They see it. Their grandchildren are in the schools. They know exactly what's going on, but they don't think they have any muscle to fight it. But now that they've read my book and they've seen me speech and they see, you know, they've listened to my speeches and everything, they have confidence here in Georgia that we're going to turn things around, especially with the current law in the books right now where the moment of silence is not being told properly to the students what their rights are. And the media is going to pick it up real soon.
Well, as you know, there's lots of good fights. And yeah. there are, you know, so many good, passionate fights, whether it be abortion, the religion, or whether it be immigration, or whether it be the tyranny of the IRS,
right.
blah, 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 blah. I mean, there's a plethora of tyranny that we're dealing with from the federal government. And on this show, I keep on telling everybody that those are the distractions. The only way we're going to kill this beast and the only way we're going to get the federal government back into the box, the constitutional box that they're supposed to be in and live within the framework and the scope of the Constitution is by auditing it and forcing, getting the states to literally force them back in, because no monster will shed their tentacles and so forth to get back into that bottle, or your genie to get back in that bottle, unless you force have the sovereignty and the command. And the funny thing is, people don't realize, as you've read in my executive summary, that the states actually do have the sovereignty and they have the power. I used the metaphor with a couple of gentlemen a couple of weeks ago that it's kind of like how Satan traps people with sin. It starts off with a lie, and then you're doing something, and then you're doing worse and worse, and you just feel completely bogged down and tied down to this sin where it possesses you. You at any point in time possess the power to break those bonds and basically repent and, you know, turn away from those. Instead, most people just feel like they have no power. They feel they have no control because they believed in the lies that you can't be better, you can't do better. And that's the same thing with the states. I truly believe the states believe that they can't do anything, that they can't assert this power when they possess this power and sovereignty all this time. And it's just time to wake up. And if we get the people in Georgia, here in Washington, and around the Republic to wake up and start marching on their state capitals and demanding that their state legislatures protect them from the federal tyranny, which is their job.
Yeah.
Then I think we can turn all of these things around and get rid of all of these problems.
Right, I agree.
Or at least become the masters of the direction this nation will go, because there's a lot of things that come out of, you know, that DC's been doing that will go, okay, so what are we going to do with this? You know, these, you know, the CDC, you know, do we need to have a central disease control center, or do we need to have some type of regulation or entity? So the state should start looking at how they can take these back and pull these away from the federal government. And they can do these things, and they can read about all that in my books. And so with that, how's the reading going?
Honestly, I've been so busy. I was at UGA, University of Georgia, yesterday.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to start reading it again tomorrow. Okay. It's a fantastic book.
Okay, thank you so much. And I wait with bated breath to hear your feedback on my book. And so if you want to, I'll let you come on the show and read me the Riot Act.
We'll do.
All right. Well, God bless you. Thank you so much for what you do. And
well, thank you, GR. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Honor and a privilege. You have a good evening.
Okay, you too. Thanks so much.
All right, good night. You bet. Bye. Well, folks, we're very close to the end of the hour, and what I wanted to do was get into some citations, but I really don't. So next week, I'll be going through some more Federalist citations, but I want to let you know in the next couple of weeks, I will be having a guest who is big within the Second Amendment Foundation, and who I'll have some other constitutional guests coming on, and helping, you know, build the case and asserting what we're doing or what we're not doing in protecting our Constitution, and how these leaders are working, and how I'm hoping that, you know, these leaders, you know, can recognize that sometimes chasing one particular issue can be more of a distraction in taking our focus and resources and energy away from really fighting the beast. And the first level that we have to establish to fight the beast is the state level. And so staying tuned and listening and going through this pain, hopefully it's not painful, this educational process. And that is what I believe my job is here. So if you stay tuned and come back next week, you'll get a little more educated as we go along. Thank you so much, and have a great weekend. God bless. Bye now.